McGrath. 10 past 8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for The Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering a research-based master's degree in biological sciences, covering diverse topics from ecology to molecular biology. With a 90% placement rate, become a leader in a science field that is shaping the future. Details are available at uwp.edu.
Welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really glad that we can spend most of this hour with a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College, Dr. James Ripley, who is Director of Instrumental Activities. And we're here to talk about actually a couple of different things. One of them, a really marvelous band concert that will be occurring at Carthage this Friday evening. And we'll talk about some of the wonderful repertoire that's going to be part of that. But beyond that, we're also going to be talking about the fact that at long last, access to some of these performances and concerts is being opened up a bit in a way that has not been because of COVID-19. And Dr. Ripley sits on Carthage's COVID committee that makes many of those kind of decisions and determinations about how to keep the student body and faculty and staff as safe as possible. And so we'll find out a little bit about that decision and a little bit more about other challenges that have been faced by the Carthage community, as of course have been faced by the whole world by this COVID pandemic. Dr. James Ripley, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Good morning, Greg. It's wonderful to be back.
Glad that we can have this conversation. Let's talk first about the happiest of matters, namely music, and specifically this concert being played by the concert bands by the bands at Carthage this Friday evening at 7:30 p.m. I know that this concert has undergone a little bit of transformation for various reasons, but what you have ultimately settled on is a concert devoted at least mostly to the music of that great American city, New Orleans. So tell us how this ended up sort of taking center stage.
Well, most of the plans were to honor some wonderful family people in our original concept for this program. And we still hope to do something along those lines in the future. But because we had a spring break tour scheduled initially, I had programmed a few things that would kind of bring us to an understanding of the South and the region that we were going to be traveling to. That was canceled, but I decided to keep some of the same repertoire that fit the personnel that we have for this year's Wind Orchestra really well. And so the music of New Orleans was just an wonderful region to explore. And we had done a piece last year that was based on some Cajun music as well. And so it just seemed like a natural extension for the students to explore even deeper into that wonderful music. And the concert band is doing a couple of pieces that are not based on New Orleans, but instead of a poetic nature. So we have a couple of different themes going on in the same concert, but it's it's a way that we can still continue some of the things we had planned to do last year as we were putting things together.
Great. I know that one thing that you are especially excited about is the participation of one of our finest singers, a real mainstay of our opera program, actually, at Carthage, and a young woman from Kenosha, London Roysden, who's a junior at Carthage. Tell us how you are folding a singer into the mix on Friday night.
Well, I have to tell you that London is a just phenomenal vocalist and person. She's just been a delight to work with, and it's a pleasure to have her on the program. How this came to be was still an extension of the tour. We were planning on doing this piece in Phoenix, actually, with a vocalist that I had heard maybe 7 or 8 years ago when this piece was first kind of constructed, that was sung in Chicago. I was down at the Midwest Clinic, and one of the performers there sang this piece with an orchestra that was conducted by one of my former students. And so I just kind of fell into this. That orchestra was from Phoenix. And so we were going to play at that same high school with the vocalist that had sung the piece in Chicago. And as we were still just so interested in this piece, and you know, Peg Cleveland, who works and is our wonderful, one of our wonderful voice teachers, but, you know, with the sopranos, you know, was so great to work with London on this and put it together with her so that we could still do the piece. And just magically, we just rehearsed it again last night, and it's a just a remarkable piece, and she's just doing a wonderful presentation. Kind of a combination of, you know, reading that book Good Night Moon to a little one, and she captures that, but also in a very kind of poetic way again, just with the imagery that's there, and the music captures things like the cow jumping over the moon, and things about being together, and noisy sounds and stars, and it's really a remarkable orchestration.
Hmm. So that'll be one special highlight of this band concert, which again is Friday night at 7:30 p.m. And of course, one thing that I know you are so excited about, as are the students, is the fact that at long last, it's going to be possible for at least most of the parents and siblings who would be so excited to be at the past concerts this year and were not allowed to be on campus because of COVID, can be in the audience, actually present for this concert. Tell us a little bit about what was behind that decision, which is not a decision you made or the band made, but that was made by those that are kind of coordinating these kind of decisions at Carthage.
Right. And I would start out by saying, and spouses too, it's been very odd that my wife's not been able to be at any of our concerts this year. But all of that came about with some significant testing that had been promoted and followed through at the beginning of this calendar year, where we had a much better understanding of the tracking and the tracing of anyone that had contracted the virus, as well as just having a better handle on the quarantining. And as it's turned out at Carthage, certainly as it has been in most places now in the United States, there's been a real downturn in the number of cases. And, you know, that's a tribute to a lot of things, including our wonderful students who are still managing to be very conscientious about how they handle their connections and their work schedules and everything. so that we were able to see it would be now possible to have more people on campus and directly to the matters of the families who needed to be able to see and be a part of the experience of their students that are here at school. And so we opened first into some athletic events where students were able to receive 4 passes for family members to come in and see those. And then it became the next step that we could also look at the fine arts performances and being able to have the parents and family members join in those events as well. So that's where we're at, just kind of gradually opening it up.
Hmm. So it sounds like it's still going to be fairly carefully regulated in terms of how many will be there and people don't just waltz in the door. How is that being handled?
Yeah, very much so. There are restrictions as far as the number of people that are available to come in. I believe we only have like 100 spots available in the chapel, you know, being all spread out, and that's within all 3 balconies. And so students are given a link that they can pass along to their family members, and it's not really to be shared with the outside community. As much as we would love to have all of our patrons back, it's not quite time to do that yet. But we have a link that the students can share then with their families, and that's how those members can receive the ticketing privileges to attend. And all of that happens in advance. There's nothing that can be accessed at the time of the concert. There's no quote unquote tickets at the door or anything like that. All of it still has to be arranged in advance. And that way, it's the same thing as with some of the church services. You kind of sign up early, and once it's full, then it's full. And then you look at the live stream instead. And we'll certainly still be live streaming everything, as we have in the past and will continue to do so.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. James Ripley, who's from the music faculty at Carthage College, and also someone who sits on the COVID coordination committee. I think you have a fancier name than that, but it's that committee at Carthage entrusted with some of the most crucial decisions regarding the school's response to the COVID-19 pandemic and the various measures that have been taken to keep students, faculty, and staff as safe as possible. Dr. Ripley, maybe you could give us kind of a general sense of how this committee has been functioning in terms of how often you meet and when you meet, what happens, what kind of conversations occur and where you are drawing the most trustworthy and up-to-date information in order to make the very best decisions that you can.
Well, the committee meets once a week on Thursday mornings. We oftentimes are hard-pressed to stay within an hour with the different things that we have to talk about. But there are other auxiliary committees that also bring information to us. So we have representatives from the health community. At times, Jen Freiheit, the Kenosha County person that's been in the forefront of all of this, has input for us. We certainly are looking at all of the county current best practices, the CDC guidelines. All of those inform what we're doing. And then we also have people that are involved with the operations area of the college and the educational structures, administrative structures. There's lots of different people that are on the committee, but it basically boils down to, we talk about testing each week and the processes and the success and just how we're doing. we talk about the vaccinations now and what we can see as opportunities for our faculty and students to be able to access vaccinations. We've moved quite successfully through the faculty and staff area, and now are exploring ways that we might be able to have a more robust presence of vaccination for the students. That's one of the topics that we're working on now, are ways that we might be able to facilitate that. Another thing besides vaccinations and testings is really looking at the processes for the coming year and what kinds of adaptations we may still need to make for the year. Knowing that we're going to be in person has already put us into looking again at the classroom spaces, knowing that we still need to be 3 feet apart in the fall. But most of the classrooms will accommodate a full enrollment now with a 3 feet distancing. So those kinds of things, as far as looking forward to the fall, as well as testing and vaccinations in the spring term yet as we finish up, those are the three major areas. And we do now have student representation on this committee as well as a voice to present their recommendations or maybe it's more their insight as far as how the procedures that we're doing are impacting the students, and if there are things that they can also see that are helping to make the efforts more effective. So those are quite a few things that we have to tackle every time, but it's a wonderful committee.
Yeah. So presuming that the vaccination efforts proceed as, for the most part, at least impressively as they have thus far, it seems like at least theoretically possible that the vast majority of the student body, even by the fall, will have been vaccinated, or a good portion of them. At some point, I assume, a lot of the worries that have been hanging over us begin to kind of lift away when we have that kind of level of vaccination. Does part of this hinge on that? I mean, on waiting to see what happens, how many vaccinations are available and can be distributed and so on. I mean, is that part of what makes some of this actually a little bit sort of flexible in terms of exactly what's going to happen when?
It does. There are certain kinds of data points that we're trying to collect that will inform us as to, you know, when the college has reached a certain kind of goal, which hasn't been stated or anything along those lines. But as we look to our rates of vaccinations, there's certain kinds of, I guess you would just say there's ways that people approach the vaccinations where they may not care to report whether or not they are being vaccinated. And, you know, we have to respect those kinds of feelings as well. So gathering a full data report on who is or isn't vaccinated isn't something that we're really looking at. What we have to try to do is to best accommodate what we do know. And I realize that's not much of an answer, mm-hmm. but we're still trying to work through that part of things where we can safely say that the college has reached a point where it can fully open up. And so we're working on a phase-in kind of procedure for the fall that will allow us to make that decision at the time that it might be appropriate. But that's one of the challenges, is gathering firm data along those lines when not everyone's able to report their vaccinations. And it's even with if we have people that have contracted the virus or not, there's still privacy issues that go along with that. But we're moving in the right direction.
Right. How would you characterize Carthage's success in terms of its efforts to remain as safe as possible through COVID? I know that there has been kind of a dashboard that's been available to really kind of chart the raw numbers. And I know from experience that at least for the most part, I know our sector of the student body, the music majors have been done a pretty exemplary job actually in comparison to more general numbers. But how would you say overall the college has done when it comes to keeping the campus community safe from COVID? Have things gone as well as you and your committee members hoped?
Yes, and even much better than what we had hoped or even had any inclination might happen. If there's any wood, you know, everybody that's listening to this is now wrapping fully, because we still do have 3 weeks and a May term to work our way through. But to this point, this semester has worked out just extremely well. It's been a challenge for all, especially with the fact of starting in January, working our way up through this point with a short Easter break, but not having any spring break at all beforehand. All of that was intentioned so we could get people back on campus safely and work our way through the time of instruction. And then with the Easter break, we anticipated there may be some complications with people coming back from that break. And I guess we'll have to wait another week to find out if that is the case, but I don't think that we will see that as an issue as well. But what we've had in recent, for those of that haven't seen any actual numbers, I believe this past week, the number was 2 students that were impacted. The week before that, it was 1. The week before that, it was 1. The week before that, it was 3. The week before that, it was 3. So we've been just very low, and that in itself is a huge success for us.
Right. And of course, you have to feel so good about the fact that even for your students playing wind instruments or the singers in our choirs engaging in that activity, which, you know, has been shown to be potentially risky if proper protocols aren't taken, the fact that the numbers have remained remarkably low, even amongst our wind players and our singers and so on, that probably points to the validity of those protocols and how painstakingly they have been carried out.
I think so. The things that have been put in place, you know, have worked throughout the country, and simply having the aerosols masked with the bell covers, or in the case of vocalists, by wearing a mask, makes it just a much safer activity, really the same as you would have with speaking with a mask, that they're really quite effective. And the other part of that that does impact us all is being restricted to 30 minutes or so for rehearsal before needing to clear the room and make adjustments that way. So the shortened rehearsal time has been a real battle to work through, but the real benefit is being able to still be making music and offering programs and being together to play. It's not very common at all that this is happening in all of the colleges around the country. And in Canada, it's almost unheard of. I can think of only two people that I know in the whole country that are rehearsing in a regular kind of fashion with their groups.
Wow. A last question. As someone in the performing arts, you can speak to this, I think, very well. And that is how anxious so many people are, myself included, and you included, who want so much to be back sitting in an audience listening to a live performance, be it this summer, the Kenosha Pops or the Racine Concert Band, or come the fall, the Milwaukee Symphony or the Chicago Symphony or Lyric Opera or out in New York on Broadway. And we hear about Broadway planning to, at least for the most part, reopen for the fall. Can you help us understand just what that process is likely to be like in terms of a return to some, at least, vague resemblance of normal in the performing arts sector when it comes to being able to enjoy performances in person?
I can only imagine that the summertime might help us to make that bridge, that outdoor concertizing is going to be a viable option. And as we work into the fall, likely it'll be a matter of the institutions, whether that is an organization like Lyric Opera, or whether it's simply an auditorium like the Stephanie Weil Center in Sheboygan that may say, yes, it's time to open up the doors. And with that, a certain restriction of the number of people still included in the audience would be a middle step that I'm assuming will still happen in the fall. But I do think that there'll be live concertizing happening once we get into the fall. But the sensibility, until there's some kind of firm understanding that we've achieved this herd immunity idea, is one that I think we'll still be looking at distancing and partial houses to make it work. But the performers, if I had to guess, I would guess will be opened up to perform in a normal fashion, that it won't be a matter of needing to restrict the vocalists with masks or somehow, still using bell covers for the instruments. That's been more of an institutional policy anyway. When I see groups like the United States Marine Band performing in their videos, they're just spread out more fully, but aren't using bell covers or masks or things like that as they're performing. So.
One more sign that maybe we're emerging from this dark tunnel. And of course, as someone who's involved in an international band organization, you also kind of have your finger on the pulse of what's going on elsewhere. And we probably have to keep reminding ourselves that this is not just something that the United States of America is contending with, but countries all around the world are contending with this, as are musicians all around the world.
Right. The first thing that I actually know of in the band world that is taking on any kind of international connection is in Greece at the end of June. They're having a conference, and all of the presentations are still being given virtually using Zoom or some kind of streaming platform that way. But the concerts are actually being given live, for this conference. But that's the first one that I know of that's actually happening. There was one planned in Valencia that was only recently canceled. So it's still impacting the festivals and conferences over the summer internationally, at least in Europe.
Right. Right. Well, in the meantime, we're just so glad that parents and spouses and siblings can, or at least many of them can be in the audience for what promises to be a very entertaining and interesting concert this Friday night, presented by the bands of Carthage College, and that others in the general public are still able to enjoy this concert via the live stream. Remind our listeners once again of what's happening Friday night in this concert.
So for the first part of the program, the concert band will be doing two poetic selections, a very beautiful work by Michael Merrill called Heaven Haven. And it's based on a poem which describes the sensibilities of a young woman in a religious order considering becoming a nun, and all of the kinds of contemplations towards achieving a sense of peace and an understanding of what she's about to do. It's a beautiful work. That's followed by a piece that's simply called Poem of the Winds by a Japanese composer, Fukushima. And it's multivaried, kind of impressionistic sounding piece. Then we feature London Roysden, a Tremper High School graduate from Kenosha, who is a junior music ed major. She'll be singing Eric Whitaker's Good Night Moon, and that's kind of our poetic bridge with a smaller group of wind players. We then move to New Orleans with the wind orchestra with a piece by William Grant Still, the dean of Afro-American composers, but a wonderful vignette just called the New Orleans Street, full of energy and a delightful kind of 1930s jazz feel. And then the major piece is a symphony by Carl Holmquist, this called the New Orleans Symphony, which describes the city before, during, and after Katrina.
Wow.
Yeah, it has an amazing arc of wonderful music, real dramatic power, and then the sense of coming back to a real wonderful musical world again after Katrina. And the last moment is just simply called Play. And it's just a fun romp for the whole band.
Wow. Sounds like a great, great night of music. And it's at 7:30 Friday night, and people can go to carthage.edu, right to the bridge, and click on events, and you'll find that concert and there find a link to the live stream. And in the meantime, we're happy to know that there'll be parents and loved ones in the audience in Siebert Chapel to experience this concert. And Dr. James Ripley, the director of the bands at Carthage College, I appreciate you joining me today on the morning show for this conversation. Best wishes with Friday night's concert. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you so much, Greg. We're thrilled to be able to give it. Thank you.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of the program features an interview from the Morning Show archives, which we are replaying in honor of National Wildlife Week.
Well, perhaps you heard within the last couple of weeks on the Morning Show a visit from our local Hoy Audubon Society, Helen Pugh and Rick Fair, who are avid birders here in southeastern Wisconsin. Well, on the heels of that interview, I'm so happy now to be able to speak with Robert Dolezal, who is largely responsible for an absolutely beautiful book that comes to us from Reader's Digest called Where the Birds Are, a travel guide to over 1,000 parks, preserves, and sanctuaries. And this is a book which celebrates those places where you should go if you are serious about seeing beautiful, wonderful, interesting birds. And the editors of Birds and Blooms magazine, which is an absolutely wonderful publication, are also involved in the creation of this book, which really tells you everything you need to know and exactly where you should go if you are a serious bird watcher interested in seeing more of our feathered friends. And I'm very glad that I can speak for the next few minutes with Robert Dolezal, who, as I said, is largely responsible for this beautiful book. Robert Dolezal, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Greg, it's great to be with you today.
Well, the book is really, really beautiful. I want to talk about a couple of important decisions that that you and I suppose your editors made in putting this together. Let's start, though, with a summary from you about what the real purpose of this book is.
Well, you know, I used to travel a lot. I traveled for both for business and for pleasure, and when I was at my various destinations, I'd frequently have downtime, half a day or a day of time in which I didn't have anything planned to do. And I always wanted to use that time to go out and see some of the beautiful nature and birds and so on around the areas that I visited. And I found out that to actually do the research of finding where those places would be took longer than the break I would have. So the book was born to fill that need. It gives you information, 35 different tours around the United States and Canada that allow you to go to places where great bird watching is to be had without you having to do the work of searching for it. We've already contacted literally thousands of refuge managers, Audubon societies, local birding groups, photography groups, and so on, in order to find the very best places that are near metropolitan areas, and put them all together in this book with great maps and a full description of each of these 1,000 locations you can birdwatch.
You were you mentioned in the introduction that by following that that guideline, that there are a few really splendid places that are left out because they're just really hard to get to. And you have tried to really focus this book on very conveniently located places where people really very easily can get to them. And so there is a sense of efficiency about all of this, which is probably a good idea for the hectic world in which we live.
Well, it's really a shortcut. You know, it's both a beautiful book to look through and have on your coffee table all throughout the year, but when you're actually in your car and you have it on the seat alongside of you, it gives you a point-by-point description of the different places to go to and how to get there. It also gives all of the details about each site. So if they have an observation tower or a boardwalk over a marsh area or some of the other wonderful things that they have at these birding sites, it tells you where those are and how to get to them.
Hmm. You give some information which would certainly be helpful to anybody who counts themselves as a true amateur when it comes to bird watching. I mean, certain information that probably experienced bird watchers can now pretty much take for granted. But things like the equipment which one should have in order to really do this well. Talk about that for a moment.
Well, you know, it's a fairly simple pastime at one end, and at the other end it can be a all-consuming passion. The sort of essentials are good shoes, good outdoor clothing in layers, a pair of binoculars, if you're really enthusiastic, getting a spotting scope, and then having photography equipment. Don't forget the sunshade and the hats to block wind and all that sort of thing.
You also talk about how there's different ways in which to really go about this, but that part of what can really help birdwatchers is if you develop some listening skills. Tell us a moment about how that can really make a difference.
Well, birds, despite their colorful plumage, some of which is real bright, like the northern cardinals and so on, are actually adapted by nature to be pretty camouflaged in their natural environment. So you might see a bright yellow warbler, for instance, that standing alone would look like it was as bright as a canary and easy to see. But once you get them into a dappled, woody setting, it's very difficult to see them. The one thing you can frequently tell about a bird early is its call. And so if you listen to the different calls that they make, you have an opportunity to identify the birds that are surrounding you before you even see them. Once you have that information and you've tied together that you're hearing the call of a cardinal, you know what to look for. You know where they are in the trees to look for and so on, or they may be in a grassy area feeding on the ground.
Hmm.
And so using bird calls is a wonderful way to sort of use all of your senses to locate birds.
My favorite photograph, I think, in the whole book is of a marsh wren. And the caption of this big, beautiful photograph says, "Marsh wrens are the songsters of the tall grasses that are heard more often than they are seen." Yep. So sometimes...
That's a classic picture that one of our staff photographers took. And he was actually in this site for 3 consecutive days. And that was the only time he saw that bird, which was well noted for that area, but he simply hadn't seen them.
Very good. So how was this book put together? I mean, how was all of this information gathered, and by whom?
Well, our staff actually pulled together all of the information from interviews that we held with refuge managers, park rangers, bird watching groups. We went online, we went on telephone, we wrote, we reviewed prior books that had been out, and so on. And when it came down to push and shove in terms of putting this together, we probably discarded as many sites as we included, because the sites we chose either had a real abundance of birds, had unusual species, or had fabulous facilities for people to birdwatch. They had blinds for people to photograph from. They had marsh boardwalks and so on. And in your area there around Milwaukee, you have just some great areas from Horicon Marsh, you know, as you go up past Mayville over into Sauk Prairie, where you can see the bald eagles gather. It's just a wonderful area.
Absolutely. One thing that's interesting, too, is as we flip through the book, is that not only are we talking about these very specific destinations where one can really look at birds, but there are also certain places that are like little museums devoted to birds. I think those are in the sections where you call them not to be missed, in which you highlight a few locations like that.
Yep. Periodically, there are interruptions in the text of the book that give you sort of pointers and highlights. And there are, you know, for example, if you're in Connecticut, you're out in Manhattan, you don't think of that as a great bird watching spot. But if you go up to where Yale University is, the Peabody Museum has this wonderful collection of every bird that has been in Connecticut. And so you can actually see them up close and personal and have a lot of clues for the wild. In other locations, the site that you might want to visit is a little further away from you than we would have on our route, but it's something you don't want to miss. So we send people off to these locations if they have time. And we also demonstrate certain species that are unusual. There are swifts in Salem, Oregon, for example, that all in the evening, people set up lawn chairs and watch these swifts come back to a big factory chimney that has never hasn't been in use for years, and they nest on the inside of this chimney, and literally thousands of these birds arrive right at sunset. So these are sort of like little tidbits and enticements of the joy that you get out of the bird watching pastime.
One great observation, again, I believe in the introduction of the book, is that in some respects it makes a lot of sense to revisit a given location because of the matter of weather and climate, and the fact that as things change, that really can make a big difference on exactly what birds you see where and when. And so in many respects, one could return to a certain spot and see some of the same things, of course, again, but probably see certain things you didn't see the first time around.
That's absolutely true. Each time that you go out, you have a different experience, and that's part of the allure of the pastime. Because of migration, birds are traveling north, traveling south, passing through areas. There may be only a 3 or 4 day period that you'll see a bird that winters in the Arctic and summers all the way down at the tip of South America. So they pass through your area, they're there and linger, feeding for a day or two and move on. You won't see them again for another year. You have an opportunity each time you're going out to, in different weather conditions. You have different foliage conditions. In the winter, the trees don't have their leaves, and you have an ability to see the birds of the forest more clearly. When nesting is taking place, you have a different opportunity. So each time you visit each of these locations, whether it's just around your backyard, a neighborhood park, somewhere in your city, or if you're going out on one of the more extended tours out into the countryside, you have a completely different experience of bird watching.
Very good. Why don't we finish with one of your favorite places that you haven't yet had a chance to tell us about?
Well, I know that many of your viewers or listeners are up in the Northeast and Midwest, and so, you know, the areas along the Mississippi River and the Missouri River have great riverside parks that the birds follow those flyways going up through those rivers all the way to Canada during the springtime. They come back down during the wintertime, and those are absolutely fabulous locations. I strongly recommend those to your listeners.
Well, I strongly recommend that people seek out this beautiful book, which comes from Reader's Digest, again, called Where the Birds Are, a travel guide to over 1,000 parks, preserves, and sanctuaries. It's a beautiful coffee table book with full-color photographs, splendidly reproduced, and all kinds of helpful information, including every spread with a detailed map, which would help you get to any of these interesting, beautiful places where birds can be seen. And Robert Dolezal, I appreciate you joining us today on The Morning Show to talk about this wonderful book. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's the monthly visit of Nan Calvert. She has arranged a very special guest, Mariette Nowak, who has written a marvelous book about how to attract birds into one's own backyard. So in contrast to what we were just hearing in this second part of today's interview about going to where the birds are, this is a conversation about bringing the birds to you, primarily through the planting of native plants, so important to a healthy ecosystem. We'll be talking with Mariette Nowak on tomorrow's Morning Show. This coming weekend, on the podcast version of The Morning Show, you'll hear a conversation from a number of years ago with George Eisman, author of The Most Noble Diet, which talks about vegetarianism. It's a very interesting, wide-ranging conversation that I'm excited to share with you on the Saturday podcast edition of The Morning Show. You can subscribe to The Morning Show podcast via Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Support for the Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering a research-based master's degree in biological sciences, covering diverse topics from ecology to molecular biology. Become a leader in a science field that is shaping the future.